At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
All right, look. I am not going to say things are bad, but they are not real good. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, the 9th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a broad survey of the state of this economy here at the start of our fifth month of quarantine. And we do so with an observation about where things stand. It comes to us, that observation does, from Rafael Bostic, the president of the Atlanta Federal Reserve Bank and a guest on this program a couple of times, talking to the Tennessee Business Roundtable earlier this week.
People are getting nervous again. Business leaders are getting worried. Consumers are getting worried. And there's a real sense that this might go on longer than we had hoped and we had expected or we had planned for.
Believe me when I tell you that that is central banker speak for things are not good. And things are not good across big and important parts of this economy. Retail is line item one today. Brooks Brothers is in bankruptcy. We told you that yesterday. The parent company of Ann Taylor and Lane Bryant is said to be on the way there. Levi's is going to cut 700 jobs. Bed Bath & Beyond says it's closing 200 stores. And I get it. You're saying, but wait, we were so close back at the beginning of June to turning the coronavirus corner and getting the economy back. What happened? Oh, come on. We know what happened, right? And that has created, in retail, for our first example, kind of a tipping point. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports.
America, quite simply, does not have this pandemic under control. And that's starting to sink in for retailers. Mark A. Cohen is director of retail studies at Columbia Business School.
Until there's a vaccine and or effective palliative drugs, unless this mutates into something less infectious, we're in for a terribly bumpy ride.
Especially in retail. When people don't have jobs, they're less likely to spend money. And with virus cases growing, they also feel less safe going out shopping. So since it looks like this is the new normal, Cohen says retailers have to start making changes for the long term.
If they're doing business on the internet, as many are, they're going to have to get more effective and efficient.
They'll have to figure out what customers want to buy now in this weird new world. If not back-to-school clothes or office wear, then what?
They're also going to have to reconcile themselves to the fact that the economic damage that this pandemic has brought with it and will continue to bring with it is going to necessarily cause their performance to change.
They're just not going to do as well as they would have otherwise. So they'll also have to shrink to make cuts just to survive. Joel Bynes is a managing director at Alex Partners.
If you think about the costs that retailers have, merchandise is first, people is second, and rent is third. And so the first thing that they're going to do related to merchandise is buy less, which will have an impact on the global supply chain.
On the people front, they'll cut jobs. We've seen that already.
And then the next thing they're going to do with rent is reduce.
In other words, close stores and potentially file for bankruptcy. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Nobody is talking bankruptcy for airlines quite yet. We should be clear about that. But the news for commercial aviation is also deeply not good. As we told you yesterday, United Airlines warned 36,000 workers, that's almost half its employees in the United States, that they could be furloughed come October. And as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, United's likely just the first in a string of airlines warning things could get worse before they get better.
Now, there's some practicality here with United's furlough warning. October is more than 60 days from now, And according to the CARES Act, which gave airlines some relief, that's the minimum amount of time carriers have to give employees if they're cutting jobs. Gary Leff runs the website View from the Wing.
It's not actually likely that they're going to lay off as many people as they've given this notice to, but if they found themselves later needing to let go of more employees, they would be behind the curve by a couple months and they'd be incurring additional costs.
And he says for company morale, overestimating the initial number of layoffs is better than having to go through with a second round if the first one didn't cut it. But airline consultant Michael Boyd says it's not all bad news for the airlines. Despite an uptick in COVID-19 cases in Texas and Florida and travel restrictions at major airports, demand is actually better than it's been in a while.
You're seeing American Airlines adding back in routes. The low-cost, super low-cost carriers, discretionary carriers, they're adding a lot of service back in because they got a lot of demand.
Boyd thinks by December, air travel could be up to 85% what it was last year. But he says that'll happen if the spread of the pandemic slows down and if other parts of the economy open back up. Big ifs.
We can see the cliff's edge coming up.
That's Robert Mann. He's an airline industry analyst. He says absent a rapid, significant, and sustained increase in demand, the post-summer capacity cutbacks and the subsequent job cuts will be historic.
It's really just like watching, you know, Thelma and Louise approach the cliff's edge and what follows. So the question is, why does anyone need to see the rest of the movie if you've seen that clip, you know where it's going.
Air travel in the U.S. plunged about 95% from March 1st until mid-April. The number of U.S. air travelers around July 4th was the highest since mid-March, but was still down about 70% from a year ago. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We got an update this morning on one of the markers we've been using to keep an eye on the health of the labor market and by extension, really, the whole economy. First-time claims for unemployment, they fell just a bit but are still blisteringly high. More than 1.3 million people asked for unemployment insurance help in the past week. Here, though, is kind of a bigger picture on that. Also from the Labor Department, this number, it's through the 20th of June, so just as the economy was reacting to the virus spiking again. It's all the people in this economy on some kind of unemployment assistance. Here you go. It's 32.9 million people on some kind of joblessness aid. You do the math, that's about one out of every five workers that we've got. On Wall Street today, tech and the NASDAQ did fine. The Dow and the S&P, not so much. Details, numbers, when we get there. Among the many things this pandemic has complicated, work. Also, being a parent. Also, being a working parent. And with the still not completely settled everywhere question of what school is going to look like this fall, a lot of families are doubling down on doing double duty for the duration, which could have some implications for job security. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on that one.
In the early weeks of lockdown, Ruth Martin with the nonprofit Moms Rising was optimistic the crisis might have an upside. Companies were finally being forced to provide the flexibility and accommodations for families her organization has long fought for. But she says those promises are starting to fray.
We do worry that we're going to see more examples of employers discriminating against their employees who have these caregiving responsibilities.
Last week, Florida State University faced a backlash when it announced employees could no longer care for children during work hours. The school has since retracted the policy, but it reflects the growing risks for working parents, says Joan C. Williams, the director of the Center for Work-Life Law at UC Hastings, which runs a helpline for workplace discrimination.
We just have hair-raising stories of the kinds of treatment that people are being given.
And the burdens are falling hardest on women.
My husband has about 4 hours of video calls a day. And so I often get kid duty, especially in the mornings.
Julia Martin is an education law attorney near Silver Spring, Maryland, who's been sneaking in work during her children's nap times and in the evenings. Like many moms, she's taken on the bulk of extra childcare for the family. Caitlin Collins is a sociologist at Washington University in St. Louis.
Women are reducing their work hours 4 to 5 times more than fathers are doing.
And even women who can maintain a full workload face a penalty when inevitably kids run through the background of video calls.
The very same action of stepping away from the call to tend to a child is perceived very differently in the workplace to the advantage of men and to the disadvantage of mothers.
Women workers tend to be perceived less favorably and paid less when they have children, while men get a career and pay boost. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Just heard from Megan about what no school means for parents working from home. But what happens when home is a family farm, which means you have to be out working each and every day? Here's today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Anna Schwegel, and I am a grain farmer in western Minnesota. I farm with my husband, and we raise 360 acres of certified organic row crops. We have had like kind of a major switch for ourselves in our family dynamic. We made the decision to pull our kids out of daycare out of kind of an abundance of caution. And school shut down in mid-March here in Minnesota. And so we have had our full family involved in the farm. The kids have been not super helpful yet, but they're 6 and 4. Pretty tough to get that to work all the time. This spring, we planted during April, which was good time to be planting. But for a lot of those hours, it was just one of us kind of high-fiving each other and heading back out, you know, when you need a break or whatever, kind of running those long days. A lot of our crop was contracted in the winter. You know, hopefully buyers will honor that. I mean, it's always a gamble every year. I guess we've never had issues with buyers not honoring contracts. But, you know, with the economic downturn, I don't know. It's something that kind of sits in the back of my mind. The really big question mark right now is whether there'll be school here this fall, because harvest season, almost more than planting, is all hands on deck. That would be really, really difficult to manage both kids with no child care. So we'll see. I shouldn't be optimistic at this point reading the headlines every day, but I'm hoping that we will have in person or some form of like a hybrid instruction for school. In farming, there's just so much that's out of your control. The weather, the markets, things that you just don't have control over, and you just kind of have to let that go. But now we're adding on another thing that's been just another layer on that cake of, you know, just trying to let go and knowing that what's going to happen is going to happen.
Anne Schwegel in Browns Valley, Minnesota. We can only do this series with your help, you know, so please let us know what is going on in your economy. You can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up,
glass is an amazingly durable material, but it also can be fragile as well.
Durable yet fragile. Yeah, it sounds about right. Maybe that's just me, though. I don't know. First, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. A little mix today. Dow Industrial's down 361 points, 1.3%, 25,706. The NASDAQ rose 55 points, a little bit more than a half percent, 10,547. The S&P 500 down 17, about 0.5%. Half a percent is another way to say that, 31.52. Bed Bath & Beyond took a beating today, reported sales down by half and announces closing 200 stores, as Marielle was talking about. By the end of the day, shares down more than 24%. Tracking the shares of the big cruise lines today could have made you a little bit seasick. Carnival announced early that its German cruisers are going to start sailing again next month. That boosted shares in Carnival and its rivals Royal Caribbean and Norwegian Cruise Lines. So the markets opened, and traders took a look at the number of new COVID cases in parts of this country. Long story short, by the end of the day, Carnival down 4.8%, Royal Caribbean down 5.8%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Walgreens Boots Alliance, which owns the eponymous drugstore chains here in the States and over in the UK, reported a $1.7 billion quarterly loss this morning. Also said it's going to cut more than 4,000 jobs from its Boots stores and other businesses in Britain. And that comes as Walgreens over here said it's going to partner with VillageMD and open doctor's offices in more than 500 stores over the next couple of years. Kind of like what competitor CVS did after it bought Aetna Insurance back in 2018. Marketplace's Erica Barris is on the drugstore chain beat today.
Most Americans live within 5 miles of a Walgreens or a CVS. The stores are hoping to use that to their advantage, says Jeffrey Gallick, a marketing professor at Carnegie Mellon.
If these stores realize that putting a medical practice of some sort instead of the typical merchandise they have will increase their sales per square foot, that's a win for them.
That's because even though most of the profit at a Walgreens or CVS comes from prescription drugs, most of the sales are all the things you walk by to get to the pharmacy. Mascara, a candy bar, razor blades, shampoo. Those sales are down. Eric Gordon is a business professor at the University of Michigan.
Most of what you can get in a drugstore, you can get in a grocery store or at Walmart or increasingly through the mail.
So that's why both chains have been trying to shift their focus to wellness. They're selling fitness supplies. CVS stopped selling tobacco. Walgreens stores have ramped up their makeup and skincare offerings. Neil Saunders is an analyst with Global Data.
They've also tried to introduce more wellness products into the store, focusing more on things like sleep wellness, vitamins, all of those kinds of products that help enhance our health.
The VillageMD clinics will take up about a quarter of the space in an average Walgreens store. The chain hopes to open between 500 and 700 locations over the next 5 years. That's compared to CVS's plans to open 1,500 health hub stores with expanded clinics, testing labs, and wellness rooms for yoga and seminars.
CVS and Walgreens are both on a similar trajectory. Both want to become much more rounded players in the health space.
Saunders thinks CVS has the advantage here. It was the first to move, and its $70 billion acquisition of Aetna Health Insurance gives it some clout. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Back 3 or 4 months ago, in the before times, when going out and talking to actual people was normal, I went to a glass studio not far from Marketplace World headquarters. It's a stained glass studio, to be specific, one of the oldest stained glass companies in the country. We're keeping an eye on this economy. Has become second nature in the more than 120 years that Judson Studios has been in business.
Hey, nice to see you. Kai Rizdahl, how are you? I'm good. I'm good. Good to see you. Thanks for taking the time.
Well, thanks for coming.
Tell me where we are, would you? Well, tell me who you are and where we are.
I'm David Judson, and I'm the president of Judson Studios, and it's a family business. Been in my family for, I'm the fifth generation, actually.
Yeah, we're going to get to that.
Yeah, and we're now in the Judson Studios, which is in South Pasadena, California.
And this is, what are we looking at the walls here, right?
Well, here, these are some drawings, some conceptual drawings that an artist did for a project we worked on recently, and it's for a firehouse up in Santa Clarita.
A firehouse?
Yeah, a firehouse, yeah.
That's the most awesome firehouse ever, yeah. Stained glass.
Firehouses aren't what they used to be.
Let's go back and see what magic happens, shall we?
So this is our workshop. So what you're looking at are basically, this is our studio, where we have 16 light tables, and we have kind of a wall of glass with an easel on it to look at all of our windows as they're made.
That's cool.
And on this side, we have all of the kilns that we're firing all the glass in. And so
you make stained glass here. You're not just like designing and, you know, playing with
that's
it.
That's right.
You're like cooking the glass, as it were.
Yeah, that's the new thing now. So we've created this process.
I wouldn't know.
We created a process now. Well, it's not many people do. We're the first kind of major studio to move into this, what we call fusing. We can actually take all different colors of glass, throw them in a kiln, and fuse them together, and they'll remain stable.
And then is that fundamentally what I'm looking at here? I mean, here's a cool one of like a, no, this is painted or something, right?
Yeah, that's a combination of the two. So one of the interesting things that we're doing is we're taking this really traditional technique of glass painting, you know, which is 1,000 years old, and combining it with, you know, a current process of fusing the glass colors together.
And also a current topic, right? Because this is how tall is this thing? Probably 6 feet tall, right?
Close to that.
6x4, something like that, of an LA County firefighter fighting a brush fire.
That's right.
In stained glass, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Is your worst nightmare that you're putting one of these in the truck for delivery and it breaks, right?
That's one of them, yeah.
One of them? Okay, what are the other ones?
But our guys do all of our installation work, so we handle these kind of from start to finish.
Yeah.
So yeah, the other thing is something falling, or you know, who knows what. There's you know, glass is an amazingly durable material, but it's also can be fragile as well. So
I'm going to get to like the glass industry and how you guys do what you do, but tell me about this company for a minute, because you have been here but in this business for a very long time.
Yeah, the company started in 1897 by my great-great-grandfather, who was a painter, really. And he trained his sons in stained glass. And so he came out to California in 1893. And at that time, L.A. was booming, right? They're building everything. And so
it's still booming, man.
Yeah, still booming. It's true. It's come full circle. And, you know, stained glass at that time was pretty prolific. It was found in nearly every home, church, commercial building. And it wasn't so expensive as it is today.
What about the glass business? I mean, how's business? You guys have been around for a while, so it's okay, but how are things?
You know, it's a little up and down. Things are actually pretty good right now. So it's interesting because we have some of the largest contracts we've ever had as a glass company, you know, and but those come far further and fewer between, you know, so you really have to be out hunting. You're kind of susceptible to tastes, you know, whether, you know, it's architecture, design, you know, all of these things kind of come and go. And so you're constantly reinventing yourself to try to fit into what's happening at the time.
So that was back in February, you know, before times. And as you might imagine, the past couple of months have been all about adapting. David had to close up shop for a while. His staff went on unemployment. He got two separate loans, one from the Paycheck Protection Program, the other an economic injury disaster loan, $425,000 all told, which got all 22 of his employees back on the payroll and back in the studio. We got him on the phone this week.
It's kind of funny because some of our employees take it very seriously and others are a little more relaxed about it. So having to have all those people work together, it's been an effort to try to make sure that everybody's fairly consistent in terms of wearing masks and, you know, washing hands.
And doing all the stuff a lot of other companies are doing, too.
You know, we have, you know, had people who are looking for dividers and that kind of thing, you know, in our spaces. You know, if you think about restaurants are putting up more divisions in the spaces that we're in. And so it's a hard thing to stay positive about, but I think there's some good opportunities moving forward.
It's not like Judson Studios hasn't had rough times before, but this time, yeah, it's different.
We're now over 120 years old, and having survived the two world wars and a depression, and this has obviously been the biggest kind of shock, I think, to our business. But you know, the good thing is that after those kind of very down periods, there's always a positive uptick. And so I'm hopeful that we'll be seeing that after all this kind of settles down.
I ought to tell you that David Judson released a book back in March all about the history of his company. It's called Judson Innovation in Stained Glass. We've got pictures from it and pictures of those Santa Clarita Firehouse windows, which are pretty cool, I have to tell you, at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, word from Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin via CNBC this morning about the prospects for another economic rescue package. The highlights basically go like this. The administration supports another round of economic impact payments. Those are those $1,200 checks that people below certain income levels got when this whole thing got started. Some support for another round of PPP loans, much, much more targeted, the Treasury Secretary said. Still not sure what their plans are for extended unemployment benefits, those extra $600 a week that most people who've lost their jobs are eligible for. And that, by the way, go away at the end of the month. Speaking of which, the end of the month, that is, the Senate, which is where this is going to be decided, is out of town till the 20th of July. All right, we are out of here, not though without this moment of economic context. An oldie but a goodie, the corollary to Andy Euler's story on airlines, TSA throughput. Is what I'm talking about. How many airline passengers were screened by TSA yesterday compared to a year ago yesterday? 632,000 people were screened by TSA yesterday, 2.5 million on 8 July a year ago. As Euler pointed out, that is down 70-something percent. Real tough for airlines to make money with those guys in passenger loads. Amir Babawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.